Mr. Chairman, I would like to introduce the complete chart for the record.
Without objection.
You've been asked to answer a lot of questions about your judicial philosophy. Some of my colleagues, particularly on the other side, seem dead set on finding out if you are an originalist, a textualist, if you believe in a living constitution, or various other labels. I don't find these labels particularly useful. Take originalism. Proponents claim you just have to dig deeply enough into the historical record and you'll somehow find the what meaning of a constitutional provision. The fallacy of this approach is illustrated in District of Columbia versus Heller.
WPFW Washington
opinion and Justice Stevenson's dissenting opinion each applied originalism. Justice Stevens more effectively, in my opinion, and reached completely different conclusions about the scope of the Second Amendment. Take textualism. In Bostock, Judge Gorsuch applied textualism to find that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act protected employees from discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. In dissent, Justice Alito mocked Justice Gorsuch's application of textualism, and he wrote the following, Justice Alito. Quote, the court attempts to pass off its decision as the inevitable product of the textualist school of statutory interpretation, championed by our late colleague, Justice Scalia. But no one should be fooled. The court's opinion is like a pirate ship. It sails under a textualist flag, but what it actually represents is a theory of statutory interpretation that Justice Scalia excoriated, the theory that courts should update old statutes so that they better reflect the current values of society, end quote. And these are two justices who are usually in agreement. So much for labels. So instead of trying to fix some label on you, I'd rather focus on the fact that you are fair and objective in your approach, that you are even-handed in your application of law to the facts, and that you are independent. During your last confirmation hearing, you spoke about judicial independence, about what you learned during the three clerkships and your then 8 years on the bench. You said, and I quote, I know very well what my obligations are, what my duties are, not to rule with partisan advantage in mind, not to tailor or craft my decisions in order to gain influence or anything of the sort, end quote. Well said. So my question is the following. What do you do to ensure that you maintain independence free of partisanship when you handle a case?
Thank you, Senator. What I do and what I've done in all of my 570 some odd opinions is to apply a methodology that is designed to ensure my impartiality and to respect the limits of my judicial role. What it means is that I am receiving the cases, and at the outset, I am setting aside any personal views that I might have about the parties, about the issues. As I also said in my D.C. Circuit confirmation, it doesn't matter to me whether the argument is being made by the President of the United States or a death row inmate. What I'm doing is looking at the argument. I'm looking at the facts. I am applying the law in as neutral and consistent a manner as I can, because that is the duty and requirement of the judicial oath. I'm also very conscious of the limits of judicial authority, of the restrictions that exist in the law to prevent me as a judge from becoming a policymaker. This means that I carefully scrutinize my jurisdiction. It means that I look at the text and focus on the text and the intentions of the legislatures that drafted that provision or the intentions of the framers that put forward that constitutional principle. It means I'm looking at precedent. If I was fortunate enough to be confirmed to the Supreme Court, I would be upholding the principles of stare decisis as I consider the precedents and making sure that the court is putting forward consistent and predictable rulings, as is important to maintain the rule of law. All of these I see as constraints on judicial authority that I care deeply about in order to maintain my independence, as is necessary to ensure public confidence in my rulings as a judge.
Judge Jackson, I have sat on this committee now for a number of years, and as some of my colleagues continue to try to pin labels on the nominees who come before us, frankly, I find your methodology to be as succinct a definition of what would lead a judge to come up with fair and objective results. I thank you for that. As a lower court judge, you were generally bound by the Supreme Court's and the D.C. Circuit's precedents. That certainly won't be the case if you are confirmed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court can overturn its own precedents. That's why I found your analysis in Committee on the Judiciary versus McGinn instructive. In that case, you had a precedent, Committee on the Judiciary v. Myers, that had already confronted the issues you faced. However, it was another district court decision, and you were not bound by it. You nonetheless followed that precedent. Why did you find that opinion so persuasive?
Well, Senator, in the law, there are different kinds of precedent. And by that, I mean there's vertical precedent, which is what people are most familiar with. There are cases that are handed down by higher courts, the appellate court, the Supreme Court, and those bind the lower courts so that even if you disagree with them, you have to follow them because they're binding precedent. But there's also horizontal precedent. It too is about maintaining consistency and predictability in the rule of law. And what that means is when you are in a district, there are many judges. And if someone else in your district has handled a case that comes out or that involves the same issues and comes out in a certain way, you as the second judge have to contend with that ruling. You can't ignore the fact that there is precedent in your district that handles a case in a particular way. And with respect to the McGinn case, the precedent wasn't just close, it was nearly identical. The Myers case involved the former White House counsel and the argument by the executive that the former White House counsel had absolute immunity with respect to a request by the legislature that she provide testimony. My case involved a former White House counsel who was claiming absolute immunity at the request of the executive in response to a legislative subpoena. In both cases, not only was the absolute immunity issue on the table, but in both cases, the same threshold issues about whether or not there was jurisdiction in the court because the legislature had standing or didn't have standing, which was the argument that was being made. The same question about whether the court could hear a dispute between the legislature and the executive branch. All of those issues had previously been considered by my colleague in the district court. And he wrote an extensive, I'm talking about Judge Bates, he wrote an extensive opinion analyzing each of the issues. And so at a minimum, as the second judge dealing with these exact same issues, I had to look at what he did and decide. Was it persuasive? Did I agree? And I did.
Judge Jackson, of course, if there had been a vertical precedent, i.e. from the Supreme Court or the Circuit Court, that was on point to your McGinnis situation, yes, you would have had to follow that precedent, but there wasn't. And so you followed a reasoning by another district judge that made a lot of sense to me, and that certainly makes sense to me. You discussed stare decisis and the importance of precedent in your opinion, and this is what you wrote, quote, "It is interesting to note that the doctrine of stare decisis performs a limiting function that reflects the foundational principles that undergird the federal government's tripartite constitutional system. This is because deciding a legal issue anew each time that same question is presented without any reference to what has been done before nudges a court outside of its established domain of saying what the law is and into the realm of legislating what the law should be." I know that you've been asked the questions about the importance of precedent before, but maybe you can just tell us one more time why precedent is important in our judicial system.
Thank you, Senator. Our judicial system is one that is designed to uphold the rule of law. Unlike other systems in other societies, some other societies, we believe that we have a government of laws and not men. And yet there are men and women who are acting as judges in the context of our system. What precedent does is ensure that there's consistency across the different individuals who are tasked with the solemn responsibility of interpreting the law. It ensures that there's public confidence that the law is what is guiding judges in their decision making and not just their own individual views. And so it's crucial for maintaining public confidence, maintaining stability in the law, establishing a system that has predictability in it, all of which supports confidence in the judiciary, which is the currency of the judicial branch.
Because of the importance of precedents in promoting confidence, et cetera, I mean, people need to know what the law is. And so precedent is important on this, on that score. And if you are confirmed to the Supreme Court, what factors would you consider before overturning precedent?
Well, there are many factors that the Supreme Court considers, and not just whether they think a prior precedent is wrong. That is one of the factors. The court has said that a precedent that is egregiously wrong is one that is subject to reconsideration. But in order to actually make the determination about overturning it, in addition to it being wrong, the court considers whether or not there's been reliance on that precedent, and if so, how much. The court considers whether or not the precedent is workable. Sometimes the court will issue a ruling in a case and it turns out that it's not actually functioning in the way that the court intended, and so that might be a reason to revisit it. The court considers whether or not other precedents in the area have shifted such that the foundation for the particular precedent is no longer sustainable. And the court considers whether there are changes in the facts that relate to that precedent or a new understanding of the facts that relate to a precedent. All of those factors are things that the Supreme Court takes into account when it decides whether or not to revisit a precedent.
Therefore, the court should consider all of those factors. I would say reliance factors loom large, as far as I'm concerned, before overturning a precedent. But basically, if you have five members of the court deciding to overturn a precedent, they can do so, right?
Under our scheme, yes, under the Constitution. Mm-hmm.
And so we're seeing more and more presidents being asked to be overturned. An analysis by National Affairs found that since 2017, when Justice Gorsuch was appointed to the court has shown, in, I quote, an increasing readiness to overturn precedent, end quote. This is true for both longstanding precedents and those that are just a few years old. For example, in 2018, Janus decision, the court overturned a 41-year-old precedent called Abood. That decision weakened public sector unions. Justice Alito first signaled that he wanted conservative anti-union groups to challenge Abood in his 2012 decision in Knox versus SEIU. This is called signaling, and Justice Alito definitely signaled his desire to revisit the Abood decision. So yes, these groups, they got the message. They brought case after case to meet the criteria that Justice Alito laid out. And although they came close in 2016, Justice Scalia's death left the court stuck in a 4-4 decision in a case called Fredericks v. California Teachers Association. Basically, the minute Justice Gorsuch was confirmed, the court finally had a conservative 5-4 majority to overturn Abood, and the result was Janus. I followed these lines of cases very closely. So that is what happened. They waited for Justice Gorsuch and boom, 5-4 against unions. In another example, the courts acknowledged four most conservative justices, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, dissented in June Medical, voting to overturn a precedent banning burdensome and unnecessary restrictions placed on abortion providers. This particular precedent was only 4 years old. Now the court is poised to overturn Roe v. Wade, even though women have relied on their constitutional right to have an abortion for nearly 50 years. Of course, I'm not suggesting that Supreme Court decision or precedents are sacrosanct, because I'm thankful the court can and did revisit precedents like Plessy v. Ferguson that were wrong the day they were decided. But justices should not be seen to be advancing their individual political or ideological agendas at the expense of individual rights and precedents that people have relied on. One result of the court's new approach is that people's view of the court is changing for the worst. A recent Pew poll found that 44% of Americans now disapprove of the Supreme Court. This is up 15 points from August 2020, shortly before the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died and Amy Coney Barrett was appointed to fill her seat. I think court watches acknowledge there is an ideological split in this current Supreme Court, when we are seeing more cases decided on ideological bases, not on the facts and the law. I think it leads to the American people questioning whether the court is a fair and objective arbiter of cases in controversy. You were asked earlier today about your representation of Guantanamo detainees. Just to make it clear, as a federal public defender, you were assigned to represent Guantanamo detainees. Is that right?
That is correct, Senator.
And then while at Morrison and Forrester, you also did pro bono work for Guantanamo detainees. Were you assigned to do that work as well?
So there was one detainee who I had represented as a federal public defender, mm-hmm. who was brought into my firm's practice, mm-hmm. unbeknownst to me. And when I arrived at the firm, the attorneys who were working on that case recognized that I had previously been a lawyer who had represented this particular detainee, and asked if I would help with his habeas petition at that stage.
I think you clarified that earlier. today. And you served as counsel of record on amicus briefs related to detention. I think that was brought out today.
Yes.
Were you working on behalf of detainees at that point, or were you working on behalf of other groups or individuals?
I was working on behalf of other groups or individuals in with respect.
Were they retired judges?
Yes. There were three briefs in total, two different cases, and one of the briefs that I filed was on behalf of 20 retired federal judges, including one who was a partner at my firm at the time, and who wanted to make a particular argument to the court concerning the detention process.
And these were judges that were nominated by various presidents, so it must have been a diverse group, and they asked you to do the brief.
And they did, yes.
So as part of your work at the law firm, a responsibility of your employment, you were assigned to work with this diverse group of retired judges and to represent conservative or libertarian organizations such as the Cato Institute and the Rutherford Institute to advocate their views.
Yes, the other two briefs that I filed were at the cert stage and then at the merit stage of a case that was eventually mooted. But my clients in those cases were a diverse group of organizations, including the Cato Institute, the Rutherford Institute, and the Constitution Project.
Members of this committee know full well that lawyers are, we have to follow the codes of professional conduct, which says that we have to zealously represent our clients, and that's what you are doing with regard to the detainees. And I would just want to note that some of the very senators who are openly questioning you for representing defendants or detainees have in the past made the argument that judicial nominees should not be opposed for the arguments they make in the course of representing clients. I'm going to quote one of my colleagues. I've been a military lawyer for almost 30 years. I represented people as a defense attorney in the military that were charged with some pretty horrific acts, and I gave them my all. The system of justice that we're so proud of in America requires the unpopular to have an adequate and an advocate. And every time a defense lawyer fights to make the government do their job, that defense lawyer has made us all safer. Do you agree with that?
I do, Senator.
In 2012, prominent conservative lawyers signed a letter defending attorneys who have represented Guantanamo detainees. In part, the letter said, quote, "The American tradition of zealous representation of unpopular clients is at least as old as John Adams's representation of the British soldiers charged in the Boston Massacre." Good defense counsels is key to ensuring that military commissions, federal juries, and federal judges have access to the best arguments and most rigorous factual presentation before making crucial decisions that affect both national security and paramount liberty interests, end quote. So the quote that I read isn't the first time that my colleagues on the other side of the aisle have tried to say that your representation and your work as a public defender somehow, I don't know, disqualifies you or makes you leaning one way or the other. So you've made it very clear that that is not what you are about. I just have one more question in the remaining time. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm over.
Senator, I'm sorry. We're on a roll call.
I'm on such a roll.
You're on a roll and we're on a roll
call. Yes, thank you. I apologize.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, before we break, if I could ask one question of the chairman.
Sure.
Senator Hirono just made reference to
Ted Cruz.
Recommendations of the probation office in five of these cases. To the best of my knowledge, those probation recommendations are not in the record. I haven't seen them. My staff hasn't seen them. And that raises two questions. Number one, whether the White House is providing differential material on this nominee's background to Democratic members than Republican members. Because I don't know where Senator Hirono would get access to them other than from the White House. But secondly, regardless of whether it's differential, would the chairman agree that there is considerable focus on these cases and the committee, both sides, should have access to the pre-sentence reports and to see the underlying facts? Judge Jackson has said she was following the facts and the factors in those cases.
Senator, you know we've completed discovery before we started this hearing.
Mr. Chairman, how did Senator Hirono, get those information that Republicans have not been
given? I'm not going to entertain this. We've been through discovery.
Do you have access to them?
I don't know that I do. I really don't.
Can we ask Senator Hirono how she got access to them?
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Senator, but I want to make an announcement. We're going to have a 10-minute break. Members are going to head to
the
floor.
So you're going to keep differential access to this information?
I'm not sure what differential access is. I'll look it up. We have a vote on the floor to take about 10 minutes, so 10 to 15 minutes, relax. And then we're going to come back, and we have two senators, Cotton and Booker, who will be recognized and then take a break for dinner. And then we're going to try to still finish tonight with two remaining senators, Senator Ossoff and Tillis, who are going to be first thing in the morning. So we stand in recess.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearing for Ketanji Brown Jackson to join the United States Supreme Court. I'm Mitch Jezerich. We are pulling out of this hearing for the day, but we will still be with you for the next 35 minutes for additional analysis. We will be back tomorrow at 9 a.m. Eastern or 6 a.m. Pacific Standard Time with tomorrow's hearing, in which we'll also hear from Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee. Yesterday, in the opening statements, she made some of the most controversial comments and criticisms towards Judge Jackson, and we will hear her questioning Judge Jackson tomorrow morning. After the news headlines, we're going to talk more about this, I think, very important and difficult topic concerning child pornography and sentencing. We're going to be joined by Alyssa Ackerman, who's a professor of criminal justice at Cal State University Fullerton, and she is a sex crimes expert. And we will be going to that right after these news headlines with Christina Honestead.
Ukraine is charging Russia with using phosphorus in the Donetsk region. It's illegal to use phosphorus against civilians because it causes serious, painful burns on contact with skin. Russia's military is now inside the city of Mariupol as more than 200,000 people are trapped there. A senior U.S. official warns Russia's warships are also shelling the port city. Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky told Italy's parliament there is nothing left in the city today. He urged a peace deal with Russia.
Now is the time to do everything possible to secure peace, so that the war that had been prepared for a long time by Russia, by one person for decades, they earned enormous money by exporting oil and gas, and use that money to prepare a war, not only against Ukraine, their goal is Europe. They want to have an enormous influence on your lives, control your politics, and ruin your values. Not only ours, democracy, human rights, equality, freedom, the same values that we have.
Earlier today, Zelensky said he was prepared to discuss a commitment from Ukraine not to seek NATO membership in exchange for a ceasefire, the withdrawal of Russian troops, and a guarantee of Ukraine's security. He said negotiators are ready to discuss the status of Crimea and eastern Donbass region, held by Russian-backed separatists, after a ceasefire and steps towards providing security guarantees. Ukraine is also charging Russian forces with kidnapping more than 2,300 children from Donetsk and Luhansk and forcibly transferring them to Russia. Russia's offered humanitarian corridors that only lead to Russia, a move that's been rejected by Ukraine's leadership. President Joe Biden plans to announce new sanctions against Russia Thursday while in Brussels for meetings with NATO and European allies, according to a top national security aide. His press secretary, Jen Psaki, will not be traveling with him since she's contracted COVID-19. Ukraine's president will attend the NATO summit remotely. The European Commission says nearly 3.5 million people, mostly women and children, have fled Ukraine and entered the European Union. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an end to Russia's war on Ukraine, calling it an unwinnable one.
10 million Ukrainians have been forced from their homes and are on the move. But the war is going nowhere fast. Ukraine cannot be conquered city by city, street by street, house by house. The only outcome to all these is more suffering, more destruction, and more horror, as far as the eye can see. The Ukrainian people are enduring a living hell, and the reverberations are being felt worldwide with skyrocketing food, energy, and fertilizer prices, threatening to spiral into a global hunger crisis.
Ukraine is the fourth largest grain exporter in the world. President Joe Biden's Supreme Court nominee shot down criticism from Senate Republicans during a confirmation hearing today. They cited race theory and implied she's soft on crime, cherry-picking sentences she delivered in child pornography cases. Bram repeatedly said she was bound to sentencing guidelines and deplored the crime. California Senator Dianne Feinstein noted Ketanji Brown Jackson's historical significance of her nomination. Confirmed she'd be the first black woman Supreme Court justice. She responded,
"We want, I think, as a country, for everyone to believe that they can do things like sit on the Supreme Court. And so having meaningful numbers of women and people of color, I think, matters. I also think that it supports public confidence in the judiciary when you have different people, because we have such a diverse society."
Ketanji Brown Jackson, President Biden's Supreme Court nominee. Tenants, advocates, and local leaders raised the alarm over the state's rent relief program that's set to expire in 10 days. More than 300,000 applicants have yet to receive the rent relief. I'm Christina Onnested, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of the Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearing for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to become an Associate Justice to the United States Supreme Court. We are going to remain with you for the next, just under half hour, and then we're going to wrap up our broadcast. Again, we will be back with you very early tomorrow morning for the second day of questioning of Judge Jackson. Today, in today's hearing, Judge Jackson was asked a number of questions, especially critical questions, about her sentencing people who had been found guilty of possessing child pornography. Many Republicans were critical of her for going with a lesser sentencing than oftentimes was recommended. Well, today we're going to talk about this very sensitive and important issue, and hopefully we're going to do it in a responsible way. And for that, we're joined by Alisa Ackerman. Alisa Ackerman is a professor of criminal justice at Cal State University Fullerton, and she's also a sex crimes expert. She is co-host of the podcast Beyond Fear, and she is the author of the book Healing from Sexual Violence, The Case for Vicarious Restorative Justice. Alisa Ackerman, I thank you greatly for taking time to join us this afternoon.
Sure, it's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, appreciate it. And it is my understanding you weren't necessarily watching today's hearing. Most people were not. It's sort of hard to do during the middle of a weekday, and we're very comfortable with that because I think there are other things around it that I think are still important to talk about and get into. One being that I'm assuming, once again, because of this confirmation hearing, that the issue over child pornography and pedophilia is once again going to be thrusted into the national spotlight. Whenever that happens, do you think we have a healthy conversation about this issue publicly?
I don't think we have a very healthy conversation about this publicly. I think oftentimes when this topic in particular comes up, we are driven by fear and we are driven by myths surrounding the people who may perpetrate these kinds of offenses. So it doesn't really give us the foundation to be able to have the kinds of responsible conversations that we should be having.
One of the criticisms, the main criticism today against Judge Jackson was her not giving the top sentence, the maximum sentence, to people who possessed child pornography. Again, recognizing you didn't listen or watch the hearing, is that unusual? Is not going for the strictest and the hardest and the harshest punishment and the longest punishment, I guess. Is that unusual in how people are sentenced?
You know, it's not unusual. I think this just happens to be one of those moments where lawmakers are honing in on this issue. I think that there are a lot of judges who recognize that, you know, perhaps the longest, harshest sentences really don't serve any rehabilitative purpose. They don't really do anything to reduce rates of sexual harm more broadly. And so I think we do see these downward departures from what would be very, very harsh sentences. And I'll just say that people who are convicted of child pornography offenses in particular tend to receive much longer sentences than people who actually have contact offenses against children. It's just the nature of it being a federal offense and the sheer number of images that people tend to have. So their sentences tend to be quite lengthy anyway. But we are seeing those downward departures because long sentences really don't make a lot of sense.
Are punishments for child pornography or pedophilia, and if these should be separated and seen as different things, you let me know. But are penalties different for these type of crimes, say, than, you know, physically assaulting somebody or other type of crimes that are also considered to be serious crimes?
Yeah, so the first thing that I would say is that pedophilia isn't a crime. Pedophilia is a disorder in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illnesses and Disorders. But simply having pedophilia or thoughts, you know, sexual thoughts about a child is not a crime. And we often conflate the thought with the action, and they're actually not related. I don't think we need to separate child pornography offenses from other crimes against children, other sexual crimes against children, because the way that we treat people who commit those kinds of offenses are very much the same. But they are very different from other kinds of non-sexual offenses. We take a particularly harsh, draconian stance on people who commit any kind of sexual offense, whether contact or non-contact. So it's not just in the kinds of prison sentences that we, you know, place on people who have these kinds of offenses, but it's also in the aftermath. So once they're back in the community, we have post-conviction policies like registration, community notification, residence restrictions, all sorts of other policies and sanctions that we place on people that we don't place on people who commit non-sexual offenses. And we are able to do that because the courts have ruled that these post-conviction policies are civil in nature. They're not criminal statutes. It's a civil issue unrelated to the punishment, and it is why we have been able to do this, you know, at least since the early 1990s.
So the Supreme Court has weighed in that we can do this?
Yes.
Yeah. And it's only for sex offenses, sex crimes.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, there are a few states here and there that have tried to move toward registries for violent offenses and drug offenses, but it specifically, these laws were created for people who have committed sexual offenses.
Is there a rehabilitative aspect to that, to these post-sentence, post-jail time measures, community measures that people have to abide by? Or is there a rationale for doing that?
So the short answer to your question is no, there is no rehabilitative reason for doing this. The research is very clear that these kinds of post-conviction policies have zero impact on rates of sexual violence. They actually cause more harm than they do any good. And study after study after study has found that the collateral consequences of legislation like this impedes successful and healthy reentry back into the community when somebody has served a prison sentence, makes it very difficult for them to find a job, makes it very difficult for them to find adequate housing. It makes it hard to maintain pro-social and healthy relationships. And those are the things that we know are necessary for a successful reentry. But the public believes that the reason why we use these policies is because people who commit sex offenses have high rates of reoffending. The original purpose of this legislation, which, you know, dates back to the early 1990s after the disappearance of Jacob Wetterling in Minnesota, was that there's a small group of people who are at high risk to reoffend in sexually dangerous ways. They tend to have committed offenses against strangers, children, and in particular white children that they did not know. And so that is where these laws began. And then they sort of, you know, just proliferated across the country with this idea that there were a few dangerous people. We now have close to 1 million people on these registries. And the original proponents of these laws thought that it would be helpful for law enforcement to have this kind, like the demographic information, the whereabouts of this small group of people who posed a threat to the community. That's not who's on the registry now. It's everybody from, you know, teens who were caught sexting, so sending nude pictures to one another and are now, you know, convicted of possessing or distributing child pornography. It includes teen, you know, 15-year-old teen who had sex with a 13-year-old teen, all the way to people who are very dangerous. So not only do these policies not provide any rehabilitative measure, it also makes it really difficult for the public to recognize and delineate who really is a risk to them and who isn't. And it promotes this idea of stranger danger, that everybody on the registry is a stranger that you have to be afraid of, when really, if somebody's going to experience sexual abuse, it's going to be at the hands of somebody that they know and trust. So it's, you know, it gives us a false narrative about the kinds of harms and the kinds of dangers we may face. And there's no rehabilitative measure that comes out of these policies.
The community registration aspect always seemed strange to me, that you could just, you know, you could be looked up and everyone now knows. I mean, it's a stigma that you can never escape from. Can you ever escape from? Do these things ever end?
No. I mean, in the age of technology that we live in, it is online in perpetuity. So even if someone is able to have their name expunged off the registry, and that does happen, it's still out there, right? There's always going to be a technological imprint from having that information on the web. So it really is very, very difficult for people to ever escape the stigma that comes from having to register.
At the beginning, I asked about how you feel about public dialogue when we're talking about these issues as a nation. And the reason I did that, it reminds me, and this is when it really struck me, and I forget his name. Was it Sandusky, the Penn State football coach? A number of years ago, when he was accused of molesting, I think, other players in the locker room, the whole nation was in an uproar, and this obviously isn't a defense of what he did, but it was just constant. When I was watching the news, it was just constant demonizing this guy as a monster, and that's how everybody was referring to him, as he's a monster, right? And it just made me think, are we really, the way we talk about this, the way we handle this, are we really addressing the problem? Are we really getting at why this happens and how we can actually reduce it by behaving this way? And honestly, I was scared to say it then. I'm a little scared to say it now because it's still such a taboo issue.
Yeah, you know, it's a great point that you bring up, and it's a great case that you bring up. So typically what we see in the media are these high-profile cases, right? Sandusky, Weinstein, Cosby, you know, these men who had, you know, Larry Nassar, many, many, many people that they harmed. But they represent a small fraction of people who sexually harm. And so when those kinds of cases are the ones that the media kind of latches onto and talks about over and over and over again, it changes the narrative, right? That we start to equate all people who sexually harm with these few people who tend to sexually harm a lot of people. So if we want to actually get to the heart of the matter and we want to reduce rates of sexual harm, then the way to go about that is through prevention education, is through bystander intervention, right? Talking to young people about healthy touch and unhealthy touch and properly naming their genitalia and like not having body shame, teaching kids that they can come to us about anything. It's not demonizing the people who cause harm. And in fact, if we created opportunities for people who might engage in harm to get the help that they needed prior to harming, we would see fewer offenses. But people who are going to harm a child are afraid to seek out help for that, because the minute they seek out help, the person they go to is typically a mandated reporter and is going to go to law enforcement and say, here, you have somebody who's a pedophile. And that word is so loaded that people are afraid to seek out the help that they need. So in essence, the kinds of conversations that we are having may be putting kids at more risk instead of having the conversations that if this is going to happen, it's going to be somebody that you know and somebody that you trust. And let's talk about what grooming behavior looks like, which includes trying to get you to keep secrets from other adults that you trust. Here's how you handle situations like that. You always tell us. We will always believe you. And these conversations should begin when children are very, very young. And then at the same time as we are having those kinds of conversations with young people, we should be providing opportunities for those who might engage in harm to get the help that they need. You know, sexual abuse, sexual assault is a societal level problem. This is not just an individual problem, right? It is built into the fabric of our society that allows sexual violence and toxic masculinity to occur. And instead of having those conversations about society, when somebody does offend, we just say, you're the problem, you're the monster. Instead of dealing with all of the reasons why somebody might offend, which includes some societal level issues.
I mean, it may be cathartic, but we don't really deal with it at all.
Right.
Yeah. I could be wrong on this, and I certainly will not suggest that people and children who are molested did as children would eventually become a molester themselves, but the people who do the molestation are, or even participate in child pornography in some way, do they have a higher rate of having been molested, or is there just no correlation there?
So what we know is that people who sexually harm have higher rates of childhood adversity than the general public, but it's not just with sexual abuse. So they may experience other forms of physical abuse and neglect, other kinds of emotional abuse. So it's not always just sexual abuse, but generally speaking, they tend to have much higher rates of childhood adversity than members of the general public.
Interesting. So again, I think I heard you say earlier that pedophilia is a disorder, a mental disorder, that's recognized as one. Yet at the same time, if somebody is dealing with this condition, they actually can't get help.
Correct. It's very, very difficult. I mean, there are some places, there are some organizations that work with people who identify as pedophiles. But those organizations are few and far between. And the other thing I just want to point out with regard to pedophilia, just to be very, very clear to your listeners, not only is pedophilia not a crime, the vast majority of people who will sexually harm a child do not meet the diagnostic criteria for pedophilia. So most people who sexually harm a child do so for a variety of other reasons. Very rarely is it because they have a sexual attraction to children. So most people who have pedophilia never touch a child. And that's why it's so important that we don't conflate the two. Because when we do, we create situations where people who really need to access resources and help because of the isolation and the guilt and the shame that they feel because they have, you know, a sexual attraction to children, we make it very difficult for them by saying that anybody who's a pedophile is also a child molester. And the truth of the matter is that's just not true.
And, of course, people have a strong reaction to this because people have children.
Yes.
And love their children more than anything else. And, I mean, this doesn't mm-hmm. just come out of a vacuum. I mean, there is a dynamic there in which caused people to be absolutely, you know, enraged and disgusted by it. It is interesting. I did not know that that somebody could commit a sexual assault towards a minor yet would not be considered a pedophiliac.
Mm-hmm. You know, excuse me, it goes back to the first question you asked, which was around, are we having healthy conversations? And at the heart of the matter is people want to protect their children. And oftentimes, you know, even the reaction to me having this conversation with you will elicit very strong reactions. If we want to keep our children safe, if we want to prevent child sexual abuse from occurring, then the conversation that we're having right now and the kinds of conversations that stem from the conversation we're having right now are the conversations that need to happen. If we keep saying we want the registry, we want harsh sentencing, we want them to rot, we are not going to deal with the sexual abuse problem that we have in this country. It is only when we are having these nuanced conversations that are informed by the science and by the evidence that we can actually do something to prevent the problem.
In the conversation that's being had at the Senate Judiciary Committee, I would say by both sides, no one's having the conversation that we're having right now on the committee. The conversation at the committee, again, you haven't been watching, so I don't mean to ask you to comment on something that you haven't seen, but I could tell you the conversation at the Senate Judiciary Committee right now has been, are we or are we not punishing them enough?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I think that most lawmakers don't ever want to be seen as soft on crime. But at the end of the day, what we really need to be doing is being smart on crime. And so it doesn't surprise me that you would see lawmakers from either side of the political spectrum, you know, talking about, are we punishing them enough? Because when it comes to people who commit sexual offenses, we're not thinking about their humanity. We're not thinking about anything other than, are we punishing them harshly enough? And so it feels good. It feels like we're doing something to sound so harsh, but it actually doesn't make us any safer.
There's also a pressure to show that you want to be harsh,
right?
Lawmakers
fear losing their seat by appearing soft on crime.
Your book is called "Healing from Sexual Violence: The Case for Vicarious Restorative Justice." What is meant by vicarious restorative justice? What is that?
Yeah, so vicarious restorative justice can be used in treatment settings or in the community or in prisons and jails. And we call it vicarious because oftentimes people who are under some form of criminal sanction cannot ever have contact with the person that they harmed. Or, you know, somebody who's experienced sexual harm wants the opportunity to sit down and speak with the person who harmed them, but that person is deceased or unwilling or under some form of criminal justice sanction. So vicarious restorative justice brings together somebody who has authored harm and somebody who has experienced harm, though they do not know one another. And we then move them through a restorative justice process. But it's one step removed from their own incidents of authoring harm or of experiencing harm. And it is incredibly beneficial. It is incredibly powerful to walk people through that. You know, so not only do I study sexual violence from an academic research perspective. I'm also a restorative justice practitioner and facilitator, and the only cases that I take are cases of sexual harm. And so I got my start doing vicarious restorative justice in these kinds of cases.
That's interesting. So, yeah, you don't bring the victim and the offender together, but you bring somebody who – but these are two people who didn't know each other. One was a victim, I guess, of a similar act, and one was the perpetrator.
Correct. Right. And so I got my start on this in my own case, in that I am a survivor and I don't know the man who harmed me. And I had the opportunity to participate in a process with somebody who had perpetrated a very similar kind of offense to the one that I had experienced. And we were able to walk through that restorative process together, where I got to ask the questions that I had about, you know, what he may have been thinking when the offense happened. And I got to hear somebody take real accountability for the harm that they caused.
Okay, that's important. You are a survivor yourself.
I am, yes.
Alisa Ackerman has been our guest. Again, Alisa Ackerman is a professor of criminal justice at Cal State University Fullerton and a sex crime expert. She is co-host of the podcast Beyond Fear, and she is also the author of Healing from Sexual Violence, The Case for Vicarious Restorative Justice. Your podcast Beyond Fear, is it about these issues?
It is. It is a full-length podcast on everything to do with sexual violence, and our second season actually launches in about 2 weeks.
All right. So again, it's called Beyond Fear. I guess people can find it at the usual podcast pages.
Anywhere podcasts are available, you can find it.
All right. Alisa Ackerman, I really thank you for taking this time to join us today and to talk about these issues when the whole nation's going to be talking about it because of this confirmation process. But I found that very helpful and eye-opening, and I thank you dearly for taking this time to join us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
And we are moving towards wrapping up our Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearing, live coverage of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to replace Stephen Breyer on the United States Supreme Court. Today was day one of questioning from the senators. There's still a few senators that will have their first round of questions towards Judge Jackson. Tomorrow will be round two, though it will begin with some of the members who are lower on seniority, including Marsha Blackburn, which should be interesting, a Republican from Tennessee, considered one of the more strident Republicans in Congress. She probably made the most strident accusations towards Judge Jackson on the first day of opening statements. Many newspapers had fact-checked many things that she said. We'll see what that back and forward between Senator Blackburn and Judge Jackson will bring us tomorrow. Morning. She'll be asking her questions early in the morning. Again, you have been listening to Pacifica's live coverage of the Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearing of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court. Today's coverage was produced by Deanna Martinez and Chris Lee. At the controls are Kirsten Thomas and Mike Biggs. Special thanks to Mike Cohn from the Engineering Department. Eileen Alfandari and Christina Onnested from the News Department have been providing our news headlines. Thanks to our program director, Laura Privis, and Antonio Ortiz for their support. Broadcasts like this are only possible because you support your community radio station. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.
Hi, this is Elise Bryant. Women's history is American history, and women singers and musicians have played a vital role in shaping it. The Labor Heritage Foundation is excited to present Women Song, 15 women who view music as an essential part of the social justice labor struggle. From the musical groups of Kathy Fink and Marcy Marxer, Emma's Revolution, and Rebel Voices, to the hip-hop of Jindog Lone Wolf, or the stirring and dynamic voices of Bev Grant, Al Bradbury, Colleen Catal, Chris Matthews, Jillian Montandon, Liliana Herrera, Lucy Murphy, Alexandra Paulting, and Lynn Marie Smith. We can promise you an evening filled with women power, love, laughter, and song. Please join us online Saturday, March 26th, 7 p.m. to